This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to begin our show talking about something that is very troubling, that's been happening in our country all of my lifetime and all of Joe McNeil's lifetime as well. And that's the racial division that was starkly brought back to our attention with the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis policeman a week ago today. Joe McNeil is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and with Rock Industries Corporation, a tribally owned company in Fort Yates, and he joins us by phone. Joe, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for making the time. We appreciate the call.
We spoke last January because at that time you were going to be the featured speaker at a Martin Luther King Day observance. And the reason was because you are of mixed race and your father was a sort of a singular person in the history of racial relations in this country. Tell us your dad's story.
My father, when he was 17 years old, organized a sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina. It was one of the most impactful sit-ins that really sparked the movement of sit-ins in 1960. February 1, 1960 is when he sat at the Woolworth counter with Franklin McCain, Jibril Blair, and David Richmond to sit down for the civil rights to be served in a whites-only lunch counter. And when they left that day, there was a photographer that come from the local paper, and he caught them as they left. And that photo spread across the papers in the South and then spread across nationwide, much like, unfortunately, George Floyd's photo video as well. So there's some stark similarities there, but also, you know, the circumstances always been hovering in the same in that regard of racial division and or privilege and how it is addressed.
That is 60 years ago. Isn't it amazing that you and I have spent our lives with this around us?
Yeah, 60 years. We just went back this past February. My father, Joseph McNeil, and Jibril Kazan are the only two left. My father, he left North Carolina A&T and went on to serve in the Air Force. And throughout his career in the reserves and retired Brigadier General
Wow.
in the Air Force. So he served his country. He always believed in that and believed in the country and for diversification and unification. So he's still quite humble about what he had done in the past and knows that there's still a long way to go. And, you know, through the lights of the events that are occurring now, you know, it's clearly evident. We're just not learning the lesson.
When I mentioned that you and I have spent our entire lives with this around us, I need to make the distinction that I'm a white guy and you're not. So tell us about your personal reaction when you heard about the death of George Floyd.
It was, I seen it, you know, through my Instagram feed and my Facebook feed. And it was something that I couldn't watch through to its completion because he lost his life on camera. And people were calling out that he was dying. And here he is with a knee on his throat. Now imagine anybody watching their family members that happened to and nothing can be done. And that's the severe state of policing that we have and the disparities of policing that we've had have in this country that exists today. He's helpless and the people around him were helpless to do anything that is blatantly occurring as it has over the last 10 years and beyond. Lynchings have occurred throughout this country's history as a way to keep people oppressed, to keep people down, to keep people in their place, up to modern times, to what occurred on video last week. I can't think of it any other way as another lynching. The ties that have come about to this police officer possibly knowing George Floyd are that story starting to be told now, which means that it was a personal thing as well. So you know, there's a lot of different angles to this. What was just on one camera view isn't the whole story. There were, I think, 3-4 camera views that are now coming out about him being beaten in the police car before that video was taken, and people have that video. So there's so much coming out about this now. But it just shows the further depth in how people of color have been, treated, but we've been living in this way that is completely one-sided, as the other side is treated in a different light.
Your father had that experience 60 years ago. How did he talk about it to you, and how did you grow up hearing from your father this sort of circumstance and kind of preparing to confront it yourself?
My dad is going through the late stages of Parkinson's right now, and he's had nightmares throughout his life that they're going to come get him. And I just talked to him a couple days ago, and he said, "Well, I'm having more violent dreams, son." I said, "What are your dreams about?" He said, "Well, they're still coming to get me. They're going to come get me." But his fear, even through his military service and being the commander that he was, the general that he was, is that they're still going to come get him. And that's the police. That's the government. That's this country. They're going to still come get him. It's hard. It's hard because he's seen it. He grew up with the violence all his life. He's seen it in his own eyes. I grew up in it in the context of being trained that if I get pulled over, that if I'm in a wrong neighborhood, that is a white neighborhood, and I get pulled over or stopped, that could very well be my last time. So we've been trained to put our hands on the wheel, to turn our car off, to turn an interior light on, to roll the windows down so there's complete access. In turn, when I moved here to North Dakota, I have white friends, and they would tell me about when they get pulled over, they would start cursing the cop out. And I was just so horrified. How could you do that and live? You know, but this was a real stark expression to me of the two different worlds that we live in. I know that my life can be taken quickly and nothing be done. So, and this is something that I try to teach my children, and I have an autistic son. He's a big boy. He's, you know, he's a big man. He's 6'2", you know, brown skinned. He doesn't have great communication skills. And my most important lesson to him is that when you get pulled over by the police, because he can't express himself well, he might not be able to comply well. That doesn't mean he should be shot, because he's a big person. But what's happened to people of color in this country is that if we're not controlled immediately by the police, if we're not complying immediately to the authorities, then we are put down as less than human. So this is the reality that I live with, that I try to teach my son and my children, my other children too, is that you need to be safe. And it's not just to be obedient to the law or abide by a law that is good. It is so that you can live through that experience. It shakes me to even talk about this because it's my reality.
Joe McNeil is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and is talking to us from Fort Yates, North Dakota, the tribal headquarters. Joe, we talk about white privilege. I mentioned it earlier, and you alluded to it, to the difference between being stopped if you're white and stopped if you're not. How do you explain that to your white friends?
There's a system in this country that was built in its onset, and the system was built by a group of people that was to colonize the country, to eliminate the inhabitants of it, you know, by law. That's where your Second Amendment comes from, to further expand the territories or expand your homelands and then protect those homelands. And those were to protect the settlers against the people that they were killing to take their land. It goes back that far. You have to have a real understanding of how far the law goes back, and who it's intended to protect, and who it's been intended to oppress. And during this whole time, there's slavery. Police forces were established to control runaway slaves, and then applied across the border, across the nation, I should say, to protect the system that's being built. This is America. And Unfortunately, the founding fathers of the Constitution had said that all men should be created equal. Fortunately, it wasn't built to be applied to us, but you can no longer, can't really say that you have a free country unless you have a free people. So when the civil rights movement comes along and voting rights, everything that was built, even the suffrage rights, you know, for women, people who were treated less than by white males to dominate this country and control the country that they built for themselves. So when you look at this and you ask yourself, would I trade places with that person of color in any circumstance, whether they be wealthy or not? Would you trade places with them? Why wouldn't you trade places with them? That's the real question you need to ask yourself. Because you know deep in your heart, people are not treated fairly. People are not treated equally. And their children are at risk as well. When you look back at that and you take a look at the laws and you take a look at the application of not only those laws, but of housing, zoning laws, property laws, the things that have been built throughout this time here in the United States, how has it been applied? Who does it benefit? So it's a real deep introspection that everyone needs to take, and everyone needs to find their own way about how do they make these things better, not just for themselves, but for their children.
Well, it would seem that one issue here is seeing people who look like you or look like people from your community in positions of prominence and power, in authority, on police forces.
But you'll see that, and you feel a little safer about that. But the rest of the system is still controlled by those original forces that built the system. You know, so it's not a one part will fix the rest. It's really taking a look at all the parts of it and how is equity. When people are caged on a southern border of a land that is originally theirs, ours, I mean, as we talk about indigenous people, that border, they didn't cross the border crossed them. You know, so 100 years ago, 200 years ago, all the colonization that had occurred, everything that has occurred here in this country, the original indigenous people, that story hasn't been told. The truth of that Holocaust is never expressed. The truth of that genocide is never expressed. But by all in parts of Americana and apple pie, we still have Washington Redskins and Atlanta Braves and Cowboys and Indians. It's a part of what is considered lore. So that's been a real twisting of, I would even say it's a hiding of guilt, you know, to the great horrifying massacre that occurred here in these lands that is claimed to be land of the free, home of the brave. It's a tough thing to talk about, and it's a tough thing to take a look at. I'm not right 100%. No one is. But we all have pain that we live with or fear that we live within, and how do we do that in a country where everyone has free choice, but a lot of us don't?
What would make it better? What advice or recommendation would you offer? Or is it just going to keep on keeping on?
It's a tough thing. You know, here in North Dakota, South Dakota, it's a majority white, you know, population. In other locations, you know, you have great cultural diversity, but there's still redlining, there's still prejudice, there's still implicit bias, and we're all raised in implicit bias. It's in entertainment, it's in news media, it's in realty, it's in finance, it's everywhere. It's deeply entrenched. But treating people as you would want to be treated, giving people fair deals as you would want to have a fair deal, being given an access or allowed a voice and where you would like to have a voice. So, you know, it goes back to those things that are in the Bible, you know, treat those as how you'd long to be treated. And that's true in every religion.
In your lifetime, Joe, has it changed? Has it gotten better? Has it stayed the same? Has it gotten worse?
I would like to say it's gotten better, because there's been more interracial you know, relations, which that forces people to look at one another, because all of a sudden you have a kid or a grandkid that's brown. How do you react to that, and how you love that child? So, you know, things have gotten better in that way, and media is getting a little better as far as television and entertainment goes. But when it comes to power and finance and control, those elements that control the country, politics, and it really comes down to control. Control. Who has and who relinquishes, and is there even a need to have that discussion about relinquishing control? Control over what? You know, controlling over all the resources that have been utilized, and now they are being changed. You know, the coal plants are closing here because renewable energies are more affordable now. So there's a fight of control over that, and who is right. You know, so we are going to go through a period of change here where things that used to be cornerstones of the economy, of you know, a colonistic economy around the world, are being depleted to the point that they can't be regenerated, and natural systems around them have been destroyed. So we're going through imbalance. We're going to see greater imbalance in the years to come, and we're going to have to look at each other as humanity and stand with one another, and not that I'm going to hoard this like everyone ran for the toilet paper, but think about everyone else that's going to be around you, because now there's riots in the streets, you know, people that are upset and voicing or expressing their anger and frustration and helplessness. It's happened again.
Well, I live in downtown Fargo, and I didn't firsthand experience it. I wasn't far from it, but I wasn't going to jump into it either. And there was a serious disturbance in our city on Saturday night, but it was preceded during the day by a march of an estimated more than 2,000 people. It was easily the largest march of any sort I've seen, protest march certainly, in 60 years. The last time I saw anything like this was 50 years ago, maybe, around the Vietnam War in the late 60s. So that seems to be catching on. There seems to be a groundswell of this is gone too far again. But do you take any solace from that, from the outpouring of demonstration, if you will, that enough's enough?
I do, because people are seeing it for what it is. You know, it's not just racial lines, it's economic lines now. You know, that if you don't have this in your pocket, or you drive that, or, you know, or own that, or you wear this or that, then, you know, you're treated less than. It's treating people less than, you know, human. And, you know, folks, this is supposed to be an 80% Christian country, and yet, you know, we have this kind of environment that we live within. And, you know, we got to walk the talk when it comes down to it. So I'm very happy to see, you know, the protests happening, you know, the marches that were occurring, the one that happened here in Bismarck. You know, my wife and I happened to catch the tail end of that, and it was good to be in that kind of atmosphere. And, you know, there was a very diverse crowd there of whites and people of color, youth that were there, and folks my age, you know, sprinkled here and there. One of the great things is, you know, we do have the methods of communication that we have. Everybody has instant access to media, whether that be social media or by the news, you know, to see the news or see things as they are. Because if it wasn't for that journalist coming to see the sit-ins in Greensboro, North Carolina, that would have just been one event. But, you know, people having access and exposure to these kinds of things emboldens people, gives people strength, gives people heart to let them know that a change can happen.
Joe McNeil is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and he spoke to us from Fort Yates, North Dakota. His father is Joseph Alfred McNeil, a retired Air Force Brigadier General and a member of the Greensboro Four, who on the 1st of February 1960 sat down at a segregated Woolworth's lunch counter, and the rest is continuing history. Joe, thanks for being with us today.
Appreciate it. Guys, have a good day out there.
A commentary from Mark Trahant next.
The death of George Floyd, the unarmed black man who was seen by millions pleading with the Minneapolis police officer who had his knee on him, led to widespread outrage and protests across the country, some of which, including one here in North Dakota, turned violent. Tonight at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, public radio listeners from across the country will gather for America, Are We Ready?, a national call-in about racism, violence, and our future together. Kai Wright, Brian Lehrer, and Tanzina Vega will host a 2-hour conversation, an important one, on this urgent moment in America. America, Are We Ready? Tonight at 7 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is the editor of the online news service Indian Country Today. He's a longtime professional journalist and a former professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota. And like Joe McNeil, he has some thoughts about the history of racism in our country. Here's his commentary.
The headlines from the summer of 1919 almost seem familiar today. Riots in Washington, D.C., Knoxville, Tennessee, Longview, Texas, Phillips County, Arkansas, Omaha, Nebraska, and most dramatically, Chicago. The spark was racial strife. Even the pandemic, the flu, had a racial framework because hospitals were segregated and African Americans had to seek care at black-owned institutions. That era was known as the Red Summer. There were public murders and lynchings carried out on streets across the country, dismissed as riots. That story conflicted with one that America was telling the world, that the post-World War I era, that America was making the world safer for democracy. And if the Red Summer was not enough, on May 31st, 1921, stirred by a resurgent Ku Klux Klan, the Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, known as Black Wall Street, was attacked and demolished. A mob destroyed 35 square blocks of the African-American community during the evening of May 31st through the afternoon of June 1st, 1921, said a report on the event by the state of Oklahoma in 2001. Hundreds of whites were deputized and participated in the violence, even providing firearms and ammunition to people, all of them white, who looted, killed, and destroyed property. Officials then blamed the African Americans for the race riot, but the community and the Red Cross labeled it as a massacre from the start. No one was ever prosecuted or punished for the violent criminal acts. Last week, Human Rights Watch published a report that called for reparations, finally. The Tulsa race massacre and surrounding events led directly to the loss of hundreds of lives, loss of liberty, substantial personal and business property loss, and damages to objects of cultural significance. Compounding inequalities stemming from the massacre led to lower life expectancy, increased need for mental health services, loss of economic opportunity, and other harms to community members over the decades. Yet the victims of the massacre have yet to receive an effective remedy. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about the growth of direct produce marketing with Holly Rose Mabee, the executive director of the North Dakota Farmers Markets and Growers Association. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 48 new individuals from 8 North Dakota counties have been confirmed to have COVID-19 in North Dakota, bringing the statewide positive total to 2,625. The positive results were from a pool of 2,378 tests for a positive rate of 2%. 40 of the cases were from Cass County. 2 of the cases were from Grand Forks County. Barnes, Burley, Ransom, Stutzman, Trail, and Walsh counties each had one new case. There have been 169 total hospitalizations, while 35 individuals are currently hospitalized. There have been 2,078 recoveries and 61 deaths. This leaves 486 active confirmed cases in North Dakota. New protocols have been released for allowing visitation in long-term care facilities. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, visits to those facilities were curtailed. But as the state moves toward opening other things, procedures have been established to allow loved ones to see those long-term care residents. State Human Services Director Chris Jones says for a facility to begin moving toward visits, it has to be COVID-free and must have completed 2 rounds of testing. He says the facility must continue serial testing.
We anticipate on Monday we'll be getting a number of phone calls. This will be an incentive for long-term care facilities to continue their testing because they would like to open it up. And then we'll make sure, that, again, can't stress this enough, the facilities will notify the families because they need to work with the families to schedule because we don't want everybody to show up on day one.
Jones says how visitation is handled will be up to the individual facility.
Some will only have visitation to start with outside. Some may just do it inside in common areas. If it's an assisted living facility with separate entries, then they can go into the individual's room. All of these things need to be worked out with the facilities themselves and the VP3 task force.
The state of North Dakota has moved to a low-risk category for COVID-19. And Joshua Wynn no longer has the title of interim president at UND. The medical school dean served as the interim president since June of 2019. Now the permanent president, Andrew Armacost, is on campus. As to how he feels about no longer being at the helm of UND, Wynn says he is a little ambivalent about it.
On the one hand, it's been a wonderful experience. On the other hand, you know, doing several jobs has been pretty exhausting, especially in the COVID era. But, you know, I'm not complaining about that because no sooner had I stepped down as interim president at UND that I'm now the chief health strategist for the state of North Dakota. So I think my free time has now been spoken for.
Wynn says he's leaving the presidency with great satisfaction, but he's looking forward to the new challenges with great anticipation. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Holly Rose Mabee. She's the executive director of the North Dakota Farmers Markets and Growers Association, also the director of the Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture at Dakota College at Bottineau. And she joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us, Holly.
Thanks for inviting me, Doug.
In 2007, Dakota College at Bottineau was designated as a university center by the Federal Economic Development Administration. What did that enable that you're related to?
That really was the funding and the impetus that set the ball rolling and allowed Dakota College at Bottineau to begin the extension and the outreach and the technical assistance to small and mid-sized farms that grow specialty crops, vegetables, fruits, and grow on small acres and sell their products direct to consumers. So that was kind of the impetus that got us rolling and allowed us to get started with all of the producers and farmers that we work with.
13 years ago, how many producers and farmers were there, and how would you relate to it now?
13 years ago, I remember sitting at my desk in like the first week of the project going, how and where am I going to find these people? And when we first started, I probably could count them all on one hand. Within a year, we had maybe 100 on the books. Now we have 600 entrepreneurs across the state. Now, some of them are doing crafts. They're not all doing vegetables and fruits. Some of them are maybe soap makers, and they're making soap from their goat's milk or whatever. But we have over 600 on the rolls, and we are so proud of how our entrepreneurs in our rural areas have grown over the years.
How do you work or coordinate with NDSU, the land-grant institution in the state, the one with the Ag Extension Service?
Really, the agriculture extension through NDSU in many cases has their areas of expertise and focus. That's commodity crops, larger livestock areas, health and nutrition. But the one piece that you might have said they didn't have a specialty area for was those small specialty crop farms. And that's where we kind of step in. We do still work together with them. NDSU has great research on variety trials for home gardens. They have great research on the fruits in Carrington, on grapes over at NDSU in Fargo. So we still have some projects and we communicate and work well together, but we each have our own specialty area, and that direct-to-consumer piece is where Dakota College at Bottineau has always shined.
In a nutshell, how would you describe the mission and the work of the college's Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture?
to provide all the tools necessary for a small farm growing specialty crops to be successful.
Well, I read an article about the time this was all formed. I think you were chosen as the director early in 2008, so you've been there since the start. You were promoting the high tunnel system to extend the growing season, and you had started an organic certification process. Are these still things that you promote, and what else do you do these days?
We do. The extension of the growing season was something we felt was very important for our producers to be financially successful and for the markets to be successful as we moved forward. Since that beginning time, there have been over 180 high tunnels put up across the state that we know of, you know, that we can go back and say we know where they are. So we feel very successful in that particular goal in extending the season and using them for higher quality crops throughout the season. We also were looking at the growth of that direct consumer market by supporting the Farmers Market and Growers Association, which we feel we've done based on the increase in markets from 14 farmers markets at the time to over 50 now. Our goals right now are really to build that relationship between the consumer and the producer and make sure that the producer understands in our changing business climate right now, new regulations, new rules, new labeling, new health guidelines. Our role right now is to make sure that those small enterprises and businesses in rural areas understand how to meet those regulations and guidelines and do it within their means and still, you know, become profitable in the end.
Holly Rose Mabi is the director of the Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture at Dakota College at Bottineau. We're talking about farmers markets and growers, and she's a major player in that association as well. You were talking about the high tunnel system. Just for our listeners to visualize, can you describe what that looks like and how it works?
Absolutely. I think everyone is probably familiar with the temporary greenhouse plastic structure that goes up in many box stores or hardware stores in the spring this time of year. It's very similar to that. However, in the production high tunnel system, that structure is placed over the soil. And rather than having plants on benches like you would in a greenhouse, you're growing actually in the soil within that structure.
And organic certification, what does that entail? What does it take to become organically certified as a grower?
To become organically certified, first of all, you need a certifier. You need an agency that is going to review your paperwork, review your processes, send out an inspector. And there are several of those to be had, you know, for a producer to choose from. The second thing that you need to do is have records. If you're just beginning, usually the process is it will take 3 years, sometimes 3 to 5, to become fully certified. And there, the length of time is due to the assurances that you are giving throughout the time, that 3 to 5 years, that you have used organic processes, that you haven't used chemicals, that you have traced your seed back to organic sources. So you're kind of building a history of what's been grown and what's been used on your land during that time. And then at a certain point, then the certifying agency and the inspector looks at all your records, comes and visits and inspects your property and says, okay, yes, we understand that you have followed the National Organic Program rules and our guidelines and rules as a certifier, and we are going to certify you as organic. Now, sometimes that process can be done in less than 3 to 5 years, depends on the history of your property, but that's kind of the usual process.
Does this require good neighbors? I mean, if you're next to a commodity farmer who's spraying, for example, and there are drift issues occasionally, is there a discussion that needs to be had?
Doesn't everything require good neighbors?
Yes.
Yes, you do want to have, there are steps that you can take. You can put in buffer zones and, you know, plant trees and things like that. But, you know, really, it does come down to having that conversation with our neighbors and being neighborly so we understand the goals that each farm has. And I want to mention that the Dakota College of Botany Entrepreneurial Center, as well as the Farmers Market and Growers Association, although we teach organic practices and principles, we don't just teach organic in the same way that the Farmers Market and Growers Association doesn't only support organic farmers and those at the market that are organic. It's just one of the principles or a type of principle that we do teach.
Now, once you are certified organic, is it the honor system from then on?
Oh, no. Well, it's an ongoing process. Being certified organic, every year you will submit a plan. Every year you will submit your paperwork that includes where you got your seed, what you did last year, and every year you will be inspected by an inspector. So it is an ongoing yearly process. It's not that simple that, you know, oh, yay, here's your stamp of approval, let's go. It really is an ongoing monitoring process.
You still grow for market, you and your family.
We actually have moved from doing farmers markets to online sales and to do some restaurant and wholesale sales.
Ah, so that's an expansion that's out there for growers, obviously.
It certainly is. You know, each grower has to determine where their best market is. You know, where are they going to be most successful? Where is the need and the demand for their product? In our case, our farm is very, very rural. It's quite a hike to any of the larger markets where our product would do well. And so we go a different route that allows us to optimize our sales of our products. And I guess the reason I say that is because all of the small farms and producers that we work with through the ECH and the Farmers Market Growers Association, that's one of the discussions we have with them is where are you located at? What is it going to take to get your product to the people that are going to buy it? So now let's pick a market channel, whether it's through a CSA or the farmers market or wholesale or whatever it is, that makes sense for you and your farm and your product.
Holly Rose Mabe is Executive Director of the North Dakota Farmers Markets and Growers Association and Director of the Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture at Dakota College at Botano. Holly, describe for our listeners the kind of growing operation you have. And you mentioned you've got it marketed online and to restaurants.
We, Garden Dwellers Farm, which is my husband and myself, and then our son assists us, is a culinary herb farm. So we grow cooking herbs. And we grow about 15 different varieties. We started out selling through farmers markets and did that for many, many years, and as well as wholesale. And then we moved to grocery stores with being our predominant market. So we've sold to grocery stores for a long time, putting out over 10,000 packages of herbs to grocery stores in a year at the peak of our production. And then now because of the change in the market, we have moved to freeze-dried. So we have a bit more of a shelf-stable product, which is available online and in certain markets and stores. The shelf-stable product allows us to not sweat the distribution so much. You know, it doesn't have to get to market right away.
So how do you go about making a relationship with a supermarket or a grocery store, for that matter? Because it's one at a time, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, it is one at a time. But that's a great question, because I've recently had the pleasure of working with a group of organizations and individuals specifically on this topic, on this task of linking grocery stores with producers. And what we have done is come up with a page on a website that Dakota College at Botano manages, and that would be ndsmallfarms.com, ndsmallfarms.com. And there is a specific web page that talks about how do you build a relationship between a producer and a grocer. Now, as you mentioned, you know, oh, it's got to be one-on-one. It pretty much is one-on-one, unless you're going to a large chain of grocery stores, in which case they will usually have a regional produce manager. But otherwise, you know, as a producer, as a grower, you get a box of your best samples together and you walk through the door and you ask to talk to the produce manager. And then what's really important is you listen when that produce manager tells you, I like to receive my produce on Tuesdays, or I like to receive it on Thursdays. I like to receive it in this kind of boxing or this kind of packaging, or, you know, they want to see your food safety plan. Have it with you, have it on hand so you can show it to them. And be responsive to what they need, but also know going in the door, I need X amount for my produce. That is the lowest that I can go and still make a profit. Because there needs to be some price negotiation that goes on.
Well, that is the essential issue to me when I'm thinking about this. How do you set that price, and how much does the supermarket typically take?
Exactly. Good questions. The first thing you have to know as a producer or a grower is, what did it cost you to grow? And we want to make sure that our producers or growers also keep their own labor and time in mind as well. Don't just look at the cost of the seed and or the plants and the packaging and the boxes that you're going to use. We want our producers to count everything. You know, how much is it going to take in gas to get it to the grocer? How much is it going to take you in time to pick this product? Do you have to have farm insurance? Do you pay extra for liability insurance for your product that goes to grocery stores? Do you have some licenses you need? So we want them to put all of those things together, and we certainly at the college can help them do that to determine, you know, what is your bottom price? What's this costing you? We also want our producers to understand that when they go to the grocery stores, when they go to wholesale, actually, of any kind, we are now trying to make a sale in a wholesale environment where the price the producer receives will be less than in a retail or direct-to-consumer setting. So they're most likely, I mean, I've seen it happen, but most likely they're not going to get the same price they would at the farmer's market, because the grocer needs to get, you know, his markup as well. What we want our producers to understand when they're selling to grocery stores or any type of wholesale, be it a school or a restaurant, is that what you're saving is time. When you are selling retail at a farmer's market, you're taking 2 to 4 to 5 hours of your time to sit at the market and do the selling yourself. In a wholesale situation, you're not doing that.
That article I read from the time when the organization was formed, or I should say the Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture at Dakota College at Bottineau was started, there was a reference to the size of the operation as tier one or tier two. I kind of got the impression it was hobby farmers versus people who are hoping to make their annual living doing this kind of thing. Does that sort of distinction still remain, and how do you make those definitions?
There were the definitions of tier one and tier two. Those definitions were put out there to distinguish between the size of operations, which then sometimes equates to their ability to bring in a certain amount of revenue. And that is actually how they were. It was gross revenue of under 25,000, gross revenue of under 500,000, 26 to 500,000. So we were just trying to get a feel for what kind of producers are here in North Dakota. After a certain period of time, we realized that basically almost all of our producers are tier one. Now, we have stopped using those tier one and tier two definitions. And I also want to clarify that we really in no way were looking at any of these operations as being hobby farms. We have small farms, 1 to 2 acres, that make under that $25,000, that definitely are doing this, running it as a business. It may not make a lot of money in a year, but what we've found in our surveys of the people that we work with, our clients, is that that extra income, and they're running it as a business, that extra income is what's paying some of their bills. It's what's paying their health insurance. It's what's is very vital and important to their family and North Dakota quality of life. And we don't want to view that as a hobby. It's a small farm. So we don't use those as much anymore. However, about a few years ago, the federal government came out with the new Food Safety Modernization Act and the produce rule, which kind of affects how we grow and how we ensure the safety of the food that we grow, puts the farmers back in those categories again and actually uses almost exactly those categories. If it's under 27,000 in gross revenue, you're under a certain set of rules. Over 27 to 500,000 is a different set of rules. So some of those still exist, some of those categories, but we maybe are using them in a different way.
How do you expect the ongoing pandemic to affect farmers markets and the growers that you represent this year?
Well, one of the first things that I see happening is our farmers markets being extremely innovative and resilient. And it just shows what a great crew that we have out there working to grow this food, sell this food, and to work with their consumers and their customers to make sure that that happens. Our markets are coming to us almost daily saying, okay, this is what we're thinking we want to do to open and to do it safely. Are we on the right track? And we're so proud of all of them. And we're hearing that as well from our vendors. The one thing that I haven't got my arms around yet is what it will do to our vendors that are not food vendors. We have seen retail stores in North Dakota opening up. At first, we were thinking we were not going to be able to have our craft and product vendors at the farmers markets because of the guidelines that were out. But we're starting to see more and more of those retail operations in a normal setting and outside the market setting open up. So we are hoping that we can begin to bring in some of those non-food vendors to our markets as well and not affect them. We all have to remember that this pandemic is not a foodborne illness. It is respiratory. And, you know, we think about when you go to the grocery store, other than the CDC and health department regulations, wearing a mask, using sanitizer, washing your hands, we're not really seeing a lot of changes to our produce department. The produce department in the grocery store isn't pre-bagging. They're not telling you not to touch anything unless you're buying it. You know, they're not putting sneeze guards over all of the produce because it's not a foodborne or product-borne illness. And so our farmers markets are reacting in the same way. They're making adjustments so that they can adjust and allow for social distancing. They are making sure that they have hand washing or hand sanitizers available. They're following the guidelines in the same way that our grocery stores and retail establishments are.
Holly Rose Mabee is Executive Director of the North Dakota Farmers Markets and Growers Association and Director of the Entrepreneurial Center for Horticulture at Dakota College at Bottineau. You can find out much more information about what she does and the organization she represents at ndfarmersmarkets.org or ndsmallfarms.com. Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug.
Dakota Datebook is next.
So much in our world has become uncertain.
That's why we make sure you get the news in the way you have always been accustomed to.
We make Morning Edition.
We make All Things Considered.
We make NPR.
For you.
For you.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 1st. In 1990, a pair of peregrine falcons, they are an endangered species, showed up near the top of the First Interstate Bank in Fargo. They appeared to be looking for a nest site, so a nesting tray was quickly installed near the top of the east wall. Unfortunately, the female departed during the process, and after several weeks, the male also moved on. For the next 9 years, a single wild peregrine spent a few days at the bank each May. Many believe it was the original female, now retracing her migration path to the Arctic. When the Community First National Bank took over the building and mounted new signs, they took steps to keep the nest tray in place, just in case. In the spring of 2000, they were rewarded by a veritable flock of peregrines looking to establish territories. Three or even four birds simultaneously vied for the nesting tray, and after a few weeks, North Dakota had its first bona fide pair of peregrine falcons in almost 50 years. In a sort of long-term relationship, first-year pairs rarely breed or nest. They bond and establish their territory. The following year, on this date, it was big news when their eggs were about to hatch. After they emerged, the fledglings were banded before leaving the nest. The following spring, the female didn't return, but the male had a number of females from which to choose. The new pair didn't nest until their second summer together. They returned to a new and improved nest outfitted with a webcam. The pair raised four fledglings named Lewis, Clark, Holly, and Dakota. The nest remains active, and last year there were four new hatchlings. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota. Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can always catch a show, any one of our shows, at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on our show, Moorhead Mayor Jonathan Judd spoke Sunday about the national and local unrest and our shared sorrow. His heartfelt comments resonated for many, and he'll join us to share his life experience and his reaction to the public death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police officers. That's on our show tomorrow. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.